email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Oliver Berkman will be known to many of you as the best-selling author of 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. He's a self-confessed self-help skeptic. And for a decade, he wrote a really entertaining column for The Guardian newspaper on the search for human contentment. His new book, well, it's out since October, but it's out on paperback now, comes highly recommended from here. It's called Meditations for Mortals. Oliver Berkman has made the journey down from his home to London, and he's in his studio. And I can say, good afternoon, Oliver Berkman.
Good afternoon.
Good to talk to you.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, so I've recommended your book to Sophie Ellis-Bextor, just so you know.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. Thank you. Keep doing more of that recommending, please.
Well, I have recommended to other people, which you wouldn't know them, Oliver, so there's no point.
I see. Right.
So it's sort of a, what I love, my wife read it and it was there and she said, you should read this. It'll suit you. She knows me well. And I, you know, because she's read all the, you know, the Stoics and a lot of Buddhism and all that sort of thing. And I've dipped in and out of various books she's recommended, but I fell in love with yours. So thank you for that. It's sort of an antidote to self-help books, Oliver, is it?
I love hearing it described that way. Yeah. Okay. I mean, what I really wanted to do was see if I could write something that would actually help people, as these ideas have helped me, go from kind of knowing what it is you want to do with your life or how you want to work or all the rest of it to actually doing it. Because I found again and again with a certain kind of conventional self-help, it has the opposite effect. You know, you read something and even if you like it, you think like, oh, that's brilliant. I'm going to put that into practice perfectly, but I better wait a few months till I get a free week to really focus on it. And I've got to get all these other things out of the way first. And, you know, before you know it, there are no free weeks. That doesn't happen.
It was quite a selfish exercise for you because you mainly wrote the book for yourself.
I mean, I've always done that on some level. I try to make it engaging and readable to other people, but I am sort of doing therapy in public with these books. And in this case, it was really that feeling that I think I've since discovered, you know, lots and lots of other people have, of kind of being on the back foot, right? So it's always like you're not quite sorted out right now. You're trying to sort your life out. Mm. You're trying to get on top of everything. You're trying to get your fitness in gear or sort out some issues in your relationships. But it's always this feeling of like, life is going to begin in the future when I finally get on top of it all. And that's kind of the idea I want to challenge in this.
And you were a self-confessed self-help obsessive at one stage.
Yeah, I mean, I was writing...
You say that in the opening chapter, you know, that you are...
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, when I was... I wrote this column for The Guardian where you sort of... One of the things I got to do was try out a lot of these approaches. Right. And it's great having the excuse of doing it for work because all sorts of things that you might be a little bit embarrassed to explore or books you might not want to be seen reading or something, you just be like, oh, it's for work. Yes. I'm writing this column.
Well, so that's important.
Maybe you know what I'm talking
about. No, I do. Yeah, I do. But that's important for our listeners to know because it's not that you've sort of rubbish stuff that you don't know about. You've actually been there. You've done it all. And it is because this is sort of, an ode to imperfectionism as well.
That's the word that I use as a sort of umbrella term for this philosophy that I'm trying to like lead people into. Because I think you can spend your whole life waiting till you are so efficient that you can handle everything or waiting until you feel ready to make the plunge with some new chapter of your life or a new job or relationship or something. Or you can do this thing that I call imperfectionism, which is to say, like, as humans, we're never going to feel completely ready. We're going to die with a very long to-do list of things that we never got around to doing. Like, this is all just the background state of being a finite human. So you might as well plunge in to doing some of the important, meaningful, exciting things.
So, imperfectionism and the fact that we're finite is a recurring theme. There are recurring themes, but it's you suggest that it could be done over 28 days. So there's 28 short little chapters with ideas on how to change your perspective on life. And some of them will work for some people, others won't. And you say a lovely thing. And again, it's not the self-help way of doing it. You say that, you know, you don't want people to live this religiously, that some things might stick, they might resonate with you. If they do, great.
Yeah, I think it's so unhelpful to get any kind of book like this and be like, okay, I'm going to take notes on every single page. I'm going to install it all into my brain and then I'm going to put it all into practice, because that's just perfectionism by another by another door. So, yeah, obviously I can't control how people actually read it. A lot of this book is about easing up on control. So, yeah, I shouldn't be trying to dictate that you read it a chapter every single day. But something along those lines, I think, is really the way to help this kind of perspective shift actually get in there, you know, right in the middle of your busy life, not when you've finally got bandwidth to make a big change or something.
And it's there's a realism about the whole thing, and there's it's grounded. It isn't airy fairy, and it says it as it is. So, like, we're it's tough, and it's worse than you think. You tell us.
Yeah, I mean, look, being a finite human in all the different ways that means, right? Never being able to be confident about what's happening, going to happen in the future, in your own life or in the world at large. Always feeling overwhelmed by how much there is to do. This stuff is just the state of being a human, and it isn't super comfortable. But actually, this idea that I keep coming back to is like, the way to freedom here is to see that it's even worse than you think it is.
Yeah.
Because if you think, just for example, you know, if you think getting on top of all the things that feel like they need doing, if you think that's really difficult, then you're going to spend your whole life in a sort of grueling fight to get there. But if you see that it's worse than really difficult, that it's actually systematically impossible because there are just always be more things that feel meaningful than you have time to do, that's actually quite liberating. You know, that's when you get to say, okay, well, I'll just roll up my sleeves and do a few of the important ones. I'm not going to torture myself anymore with this notion of one day getting to on top of everything.
If you shift and you think to yourself that it's not difficult, it's actually impossible, and that's liberating, right? That's what I'm just repeating so that people, yeah. And you've lovely quotes in it, obviously, and you've, on our behalf, the reader's behalf, you've gone through loads of philosophy and other types of books. And you've sort of gleaned some words of wisdom. One, for example, is our suffering is believing there's a way out. You see, it all sounds quite dark, doesn't it?
it's the darkness before the light.
Is it?
Right?
That's
a quote that I love. This idea you get comes a lot in Zen Buddhism, especially.
Yeah.
This idea that the problem is not that you have not solved life, fixed all your problems, organized and decluttered, and you know, the problem is not that you haven't solved that. The problem is that you think there ought to be a solution to being a human, and that life is like a problem you've got to solve. That's what leads to us feeling so sort of, you know, down on ourselves and overwhelmed and all the rest of it.
And that sounds quite hard to get your head around, doesn't it? But your book is very accessible. That's the brilliant thing about it, because I'd say, I don't know, I can't speak for our listeners, but I'd say some people you know, are reading about meditation and philosophy and all that, and they dip into it, and it just doesn't resonate with them. And that there's a word I've used twice, but your book does, because it's all very practical. The odd thing is, you say that, well, I'm paraphrasing you now, if you're looking for a list of things to do, you've come to the wrong place.
Yeah, I mean, one thing people sometimes want, if you're offering them a book about, you know, how to make life feel a bit richer and more meaningful, is like, you know, do this, do this, do this, do this. The thing is, we all know what those things are, right? Nobody needs telling that it's have rich social relationships, try to find meaningful work, spend time in nature. That isn't the problem, right? The problem is not that we don't know what the list is. The problem, in my experience anyway, is you know what the list is and you just don't do it and don't do it for week after week and month after month. So that's what I wanted to focus on.
Yeah, and you've a lot of ways of just doing it, and that you don't quote Nike, but that seems to be a recurring theme as well. Just do it. And that we can easily become the person who plans to do something and never does it. So sign up for 6 weeks of Pilates or pottery, or we're going to do the yoga, and we're going to do yoga every day, or we're going to meditate every day. And what do you think of those things that we say to ourselves?
I mean, it's totally understandable, right? But that we go in that direction. But I think ultimately that idea that it's basically the idea that you decide you're going to become the kind of person who like goes to the gym all the time, or who meditates multiple times a week, or whatever it is. It's instead of just doing the thing for 5 minutes today. And I think, you know, just to get psychological about it. The reason for that is that those big plans, those drawing up the program of your fitness goals for the next year or whatever, that makes you feel in control, which is what we really crave as humans. Whereas to actually just do the thing, to go on a run or to, you know, try writing the first paragraph of that novel you've spent forever thinking about, or whatever it is, that is the opposite of control. That's kind of surrendering control and just saying like, okay, see how this goes.
Yeah.
And it's weirdly scary, considering that very often, of course, there's no real physical risk. Like, you're not going to get killed by trying to write the first paragraph of a novel.
Or you know, learn the piano or whatever it is that you've been putting off.
Exactly.
Just do it. And it will be imperfect, because most of life, if not all of life, is imperfect.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm really constantly trying to stress this difference between like 10 minutes of doing anything really badly with no confidence that you'll come back and do it the next day, but actually doing it in the real world is obviously worth infinitely more than kind of all these kind of wonderful concepts about how we're going to do it later.
And you talk about making decisions and big life decisions. You talk about, say, you know, leaving your partner or leaving your job or start, you know, starting a new business, leaving your career and changing your and those things can be overwhelming for people. You know, they know they want to do it, probably have to do it, but it overpowers them. So what's your advice on that?
I mean, that sort of idea comes up quite a few different times. But one of the ways that I'm writing about it is off the back of this quote from the American psychotherapist Sheldon Kopp, who said, you're free to do whatever you like. You need only face the consequences, which I think is a kind of incredibly deep and liberating the more you think about it. Because he's basically saying, look, there are going to be downsides. This is just built into being human. There are going to be downsides to every decision we make, whether they are big life choices or like how to use the next half hour of your time or something. And all you're doing is choosing which set of problems you'd like to incur, right? I mean, if you spend another hour at work, then you get some work done, but you don't get to see your family for that hour. If you leave work an hour early to see your family, you keep people at work waiting and you get to spend time with your family, to give an example. That's fine. It's just trade-offs. And I think people find it very sort of refreshing to realize that it really is just trade-offs. It isn't that there's a question of waiting for like option C that enables you to do it with no downsides. So that's one part of the approach to that, I think.
I suppose there are a lot of things in the book about how we live today as opposed to 40 years ago, a generation ago, maybe two generations ago, where we're constantly busy. We're constantly being bombarded with information from every which way. And busy is nearly worn as a badge of honour. How are you? Very busy, very busy, very busy, very busy. Yeah. You have to do that. Busy, busy, busy. And everyone's so busy, busy talking about being busy that they're too busy to actually talk about the important things. So how do we deal with that? And I'm thinking you were going about the to-do list as part of the business, isn't it? You know, you do it and you tick it off and you know, I have to ring the insurance person. The bin is cracked, so I have to ring Panda and all those things, you know, and Sky isn't working and all that. And then you have the list and there's 10 things and you get to the end of the day and there's only 5 things done and you feel disappointed in yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's an endemic problem because that attempt to like clear the decks is never going to work because there's effectively an infinite number of things to come in and fill the decks. And also, by the way, the better you get at clearing the decks, the faster the decks fill up because you like reply to people's emails. So they reply to your emails and you end up, or whatever it is, you know, you do more things in the world. You get more things you have to deal with. Mm. I think a big part of the answer there, and I've got some practical methods in the book as well we can talk about if you like, but I think a big part of the answer is just seeing like this moment is never coming when you've got all this stuff out of the way and you can finally breathe a sigh of relief and say, okay, now I get to enjoy life or read a novel or whatever it is. You've got to take some of that future dream of serenity and sort of bring it into the present and just say, I've got to claim this in the middle of the overwhelm, because if I keep fighting to get to the point where everything is done and all the items are crossed off, like you will
that's impossible.
Die before that. You will die before that happens, just to be morbid about it.
Yeah, but and this is brilliant as well. You say like here and now is real life. So, but a lot of us have our eye on a future prize, a future project, a future version of ourselves, and we're preparing for that now instead of actually living now. We're preparing for the future.
Yeah, it's totally understandable. And obviously some of the things that we do, you do have to think ahead, right? Yeah. You do have to plan for retirement. You do do things in your work because of what you want to achieve a year from now or whatever. But it's when you get to that point of thinking like, that's going to be real life. There was a psychotherapist, Marie-Louise von Franz, who called this the provisional life, right? Nothing that you're doing now is quite real. And then it's all coming later. And, you know, if you're 20, I think that's kind of a forgivable thing. But I can say from experience, you know, as you get into your mid and late 40s, to keep believing that the moment of truth is coming at some future time, it sort of gets less and less credible.
And is that, Oliver, because we believe that other people have the secret and we don't have it? Is that part of it?
That's definitely part of it, yeah. Right? Because we compare our insides with other people's outsides, as the saying goes.
That's brilliant. You know? It sounds like something from an animated movie, but it's good.
There's some great animated movies.
Yes,
That sense that, like, why is it only me that has an internal monologue that says I don't feel ready to make this next step, or I should be more organized? And it's like, well, it's not only you that has an inner monologue, it's that you can only hear your inner monologue. I think that truth that, like, everyone is winging it is a very, very important one to internalize.
Yeah, I hear that a lot, and nobody really knows what they're doing. But then the person who got the men into space and onto the moon, they obviously knew what they were doing. That's what I think.
Yeah, no, I get this response sometimes when I write about that, you know, about like, well, what about airline pilots or open heart surgeons?
Yes, yeah.
And I have actually heard from one or two of them sort of in agreement, people who do those kinds of jobs. The point is not that there's no such thing as a body of knowledge, right? The point is not that, you know, I could be just as good conducting open heart surgery as a person with qualifications. and experience. The point is that all of us, by definition, are just sort of constantly on the edge of the moment, of the next moment. We don't know what's coming next. We are improvising. Now, you can improvise in certain professions with a lot of preparation behind you, absolutely. But life still has that quality of, like, you know, nobody knows exactly what's happening in the next moment. You're responding to whatever it is that happens, hopefully using some expertise. And that, like, that's really important, because otherwise what people think is, I've got to be certain in advance that I know what I'm doing and that everything is going to go right. And you can never be certain of the future in advance. So it's actually really sort of relaxing to realize.
And you say in the book as well that thinking, you know, and planning takes the joy out of living sometimes.
Well, this is the other thing. And I'm so glad you raised that, because I found this when I was a real sort of time management geek person back in the day. Even if you succeed in scheduling the life out of your day, right, even if you get that level of control, it turns out like you don't really want it, right? It's something is lost, as I say, scheduling the life out of it. I mean, the resonance, the vibrancy is gone. It turns out really that when you look at life, even though we think we want more certainty, especially in these kinds of times, you know, in the world, actually too much certainty is really unpleasant space to be in. And if you look backwards at your own life and think about anything you're really grateful you've got, whether it's came from a meeting when you first met somebody or a job opportunity or something like that, they never are things that happened as a result of plans coming together. They're always serendipitous chance occurrences.
You mentioned there about the world we live in, and you're interesting on the amount of information, and maybe because, you know, you would think you can never care too much, but you probably would argue that you can care too much. And particularly in the world we live in now, because we have global tragedy on loop, if you want it. It's social media is just there. It brings all these horrible events close to us. And that wasn't the case, you know, 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, I think it's so easy to lose sight of this. Prior to digital communications, the greatest saints in history, you know, the people who were the most incredibly compassionate, were never asked to care about a fraction of the things that we're asked to care about every day, because they just didn't know that it was happening.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important, if you're the kind of person who wants to feel like you're, you know, being a good citizen and doing some good in the world, to realize that, like, it's a question of paying attention, but it's also a question of withdrawing attention and sort of picking your battles and saying, like, you know, what are my one or two causes going to be? And I'm going to give myself permission to sort of disattend from the rest, because otherwise all you do is you just sort of spend all day doom scrolling, kind of dissipating your care over too many things.
Yeah, so you can care too much. Can you stay with us, Oliver? I have a quick commercial break, but I've more questions to ask you after this. A quick commercial break.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
We're talking to Oliver Berkman. His book, Meditation for Mortals, is now available in paperback, which I've had for a long time. I don't know where I got my paperback version of it, but it's there and highly recommended from here. I was saying it's been out since September, so have you got a reaction to it, Oliver, the book?
Yeah, I have. And look, I mean, it's always really self-selecting, right? People send lovely emails, and probably if they hate my guts, they're less likely to do that. But I think that the thing that, I mean, since you're inviting me to say something that about what people like about it, I assume, I'm going to say that I think that there is a real sense that you get that, like, this is how people feel, right? That I'm articulating something that I'm very relieved to hear it, by the way, that it isn't just me. This feeling of perpetually being on the back foot, like you're just not quite there, you're not quite on top of things. Maybe the next book, maybe the next TV show about how to get your life figured out will solve it. And just that real shared sense of kind of permission to say, like, now that's not necessarily ever coming, and that isn't a reason to despair or sink into gloom, right? That's actually a reason to get on with the things that we care about now.
You mentioned early on that you have some concrete advice. I think that's the three things: renegotiate existing commitments, isolate your backlog, treat your to-do list as a menu. So you might go through that with us.
So they're just different ways in which we can sort of face the fact of finitude when it comes to
finitude. It's a nice word. I've never come across a finitude before.
Well, I say finitude. Some people think it's finitude, but finiteness, you know, would be the less elegant version. It's
limited.
All it means,
we're limited.
Yeah. I think that just to pick one of those, the idea of thinking of your to-do list as a menu. A good example here before to-do list, by the way, is just like if you've got like a pile of things to read, right? Books on your nightstand, or, you know, podcasts in the podcast app, or I'll read it late, articles you've bookmarked to read later. It's really good to realize that this supply is effectively infinite. You're not going to get through to the end of that list. That is a list that it's really useful to think of as a kind of a menu. It's like, okay, what would I like to pick from? What would I like to pick from this kind of abundant list of things? And the truth is that if we are finite humans, as we are, all to-do lists are basically menus. They're like things you can pick some things from rather than things you're trying to get to the end of. So I think that can be really useful. The other thing I can talk about, if you like, but I really like as a practical technique here, is the idea of keeping a done list as well as a.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. So it means that it's a positive thing as opposed to a negative thing. So unlike looking at the 10 things and only having 5 done, you have 5 things done, and there's nothing else there to bring you down, which is
right,
great.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not saying tear up your to-do list, like that can be useful too, but just something that refocuses you, because it's so easy to compare like what you've managed to get through today with all the things that need doing, but that's like comparing with infinity, so it's always going to be pretty depressing. A done list turns it around. Yeah,
perfection stalls us, imperfection frees us, and it's that thing, which this is one of the takeaways for me, because we all have these thoughts about people in our lives, and it might be, oh yeah, I must send a text to them. And what you say in the book is that we often procrastinate over, composing the perfect text to a person, when we should just be happy with the imperfection of the moment.
Right, absolutely. And it would be one thing if when you had that thought, you then a bit later when you had lots of energy and were feeling great, sent the text. Of course, what really happens is that we say, like, okay, I'm going to wait till I have more energy or I'm feeling in a better mood for doing this. And that time never comes because there are new challenges in those moments. There's a really lovely idea that I quote from the meditation teacher, Joseph Goldstein, who says, like, whenever you, his practice that he tries to follow is whenever you have like a generous motivation, like you feel like reaching out to someone to say something nice, or you feel like giving some money to a charity or something, try and make it your practice to act on that immediately. Mm. So not, it's not to become a nicer person. That's very challenging, but just to recognize the times when you already are a nice person.
No, but that's important. And to turn that's that into action. Because I suppose what you're saying is that there's a lot of goodness in us and sometimes we don't act on that goodness for whatever
exactly.
reason.
Exactly, right.
So if you get into the habit of acting on it, then you will become a better person as a result, yes.
Well, and it's a lot easier.
Your inside will become your outside.
Exactly.
Yeah. My wife's favourite chapter was the scruffy hospitality thing. Will you explain that to us?
Oh, yeah. I can't take credit for the term. That comes from an Anglican pastor in Tennessee called Jack King. But this idea, basically he and his wife had this, you know, they loved having people around for dinner, but they realised they developed this kind of long mental checklist of all the things they had to do to make it really perfect. Clean up the house, mow the lawn, choose a really nice meal, go out and buy the ingredients and all the rest of it, to the point that it was dissuading them from actually inviting people around. Mm. So they embraced instead this idea he calls scruffy hospitality, which I found really liberating too, which is like, let's value the hospitality and the connection more than the fancy show of things. Invite people around with the house as it is to eat whatever's in the cupboards. And of course, not only is this fine, like people don't mind and they're not offended, it's actually better than fine because it really feels like you've welcomed someone into your life when you let them see what your life is really like instead of always putting on a show. So I think that can be a really... Yeah. I really love that idea.
And the suggestion is that it's more intimate then, that you allow them to see life as it is with the toys still on the floor, you know, and the whatever else.
Yeah, and I always have that feeling when I'm invited round. It's just the difficult thing is realising that the other person is going to have that reaction too if you invite them round. Yeah.
You can't hoard your life. There's a great columnist in Ireland called Fintan O'Toole, and he's writing today about the Pope's funeral and the fact that some of the priests there were doing selfies. And he expands it. He expands it into, you know, that's it. We're and the Pope himself back in 2017 when he was alive would have said, "I'd prefer if you didn't, you know, hold up your phones." But we're all trying to do that, aren't we? To build up this big back catalogue of memories digitally stored somewhere that we'd probably never revisit.
Yeah, I love his work. I haven't read that column yet, but it sounds spot on. I mean, I think what we're often trying to do is, it's almost like you're in an interesting moment or an important moment or a happy moment, not in the case of the funeral selfies, but, you know, a valuable moment. And you think, like, I can really get extra value out of this by somehow taking ownership of it. And obviously, taking photos is one way of doing that. Of course, it has the opposite effect. You're less there and as a result of trying to hoard it. And you don't get to take ownership of it because everything is transient and you can't take it with you. And so the you actually have to get a little bit better at almost being willing to waste those moments in order to plunge more fully into them, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Are you hopeful for the human race? There's a big question for you.
it's a question to which you can't answer no, really. It's like, that would be a bombshell. No, I say two other things. I think that, you know, we can get a little bit bogged down in the idea of hope. Sometimes it feels like, well, how can I do anything, take the next step, support a certain cause if I'm not really hopeful or indeed confident that it's going to work out in the end? And I think it's really important to realise that actually you can do things for other reasons than that. As other people have said before me, you know, you don't care for your kids because you hope that they are going to turn out to be super successful adults. You may well hope that, but you care for them because you love them. And you can have that attitude to the whole of life, I think. Also, I think it's just worth remembering, you said before, like how different it would have been for people decades before. Think about how much uncertainty would have just been absolutely endemic for the life of a, in the life of like a medieval peasant.
Oh, no, yeah, we were talking about Stonehenge yesterday, not Stonehenge. what's our... Newgrange, that's our Stonehenge, Newgrange. Okay. And I was talking to a man yesterday and I was actually quoting from your book. I didn't mention the book. It's that everything was made by humans in French.
I think it's like, absolutely. This idea that like you can look around at all the achievements, that you know, the technologies you see, the books you read, the art or things indeed like Stonehenge and
Newgrange,
and you can Newgrange, sorry, and you can you can get kind of intimidated, or you can think that that's a different category of person who can create something like that. But of course, every single thing apart from the natural environment was made by humans, just as flawed as imperfect as you are. And that's the reason to get on with doing the things that you've been thinking you might like to do, basically.
Your conversation with Oliver reminds me of my father's favourite sayings. This is life. It's not a dress rehearsal.
I mean, that's it, basically. Yeah. That's the point. Yeah.
On Friday evening, I feel like getting in touch with some people. Come Monday, they want to meet. I'm suddenly not in the mood, says Eddie. Eddie's probably writing his own book. Oliver Berkman, Meditation for Mortals, highly recommended from here, and it's available in paperback now. Oliver, I really enjoyed that chat. Thank you very much for coming into
the
studio.
Me too, thank you.
Thank you. Bye now. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.